members of this NPR station.
And next on Morning Edition, we'll hear from Joe Hovel, Director of Partners in Forestry Landowner Cooperative. They're having their annual meeting Saturday in Boulder Junction. Part of the meeting will be a session open to public discussion on the economics of land conservation. Ken Krall spoke to Hovel about some topics during the public session.
We've talked for years about the benefits of forest land conservation, and there are many, you know, from intrinsic, environmental, social benefits, and so on. Now, as we recognize our role as a leader in forest land conservation issues in the area, we are going to discuss the economics involved in land conservation. And probably the brightest spot in the Northwoods economy these days is the forest products sector. There's high demand and record stumpage prices these days, yet there are thousands of acres in Vilas and surrounding counties here that have been parcelized, fragmented, out of forestry production to support, frankly, an overabundance of second homes, which have flooded the market at prices well below replacement costs. It's almost as if we have assumed for decades that forestry was only the best use of the land until it could be subdivided. And, you know, many have fallen to the paradox that development is the only solution to our economy. And yet, through all this, there's been way too little talk of developing more non-polluting forest products processing facilities which add value to the resource before it leaves the area and offering good jobs to help keep our young people here. There is a large issue at play here that we're going to try to bring our discussion, let's say, to the next level. On December 6th, we want to bring these concerns to the forefront with an informal program titled The Economics of Land Conservation, where people who attend are welcome to question our panel of experts. We want to discuss the economic return of growing trees, at what point the economic and biological maturity merge, the proper management to achieve the best return for the long term, and so on. We also will discuss strategies for the family woodland owner interested in transferring their land to their heirs or seeking conservation options, and any tax implications for this process. We also need to talk about the importance of the Land and Water Conservation Fund and the Stewardship Fund as necessary tools to keep the healthy forest industry and provide the open space needed by society.
I know the parcelization issue of forestry obviously is at the forefront, but I know biologists have been very concerned in terms of animals and so forth that need long stretches of forest. Is that part of something you can say?
Habitat is one of the long-term social benefits of environmental benefits of land conservation. I mean, habitat's a very, very important one. And you know, we really can't discriminate from one benefit to another because they're interlinked. In other words, the habitat that's so essential for wildlife also is essential for the tourism industry. So and the tourism industry obviously benefits from forest land conservation because people don't travel to northern Wisconsin to see stumps and blacktop. It's that simple.
Joe Hovel from Partners in Forestry Landowner Cooperative. The meeting is Saturday at Big Bear Hideaway in Boulder Junction. You can contact Hovel at 715-479-8528 or the Partners in Forestry website for more information.
You know, we want to thank everybody for coming. We've got just a great representation here. Besides having some landowners, we've got a bunch of foresters. We've got some real estate people. We got loggers. We got an industry procurement guy.
I'd like to introduce our panel. John Schwartzman, first of all, I'm sure the vast majority of you know him, Forest Service Supervisor for Wisconsin Board of Commissioners of Public Lands, who has a long time experience in sustainable forest management and conservation. And all, as I said before, John also serves as a fifth vice president. And then, Dick is Retired from almost a 40-year career with the DNR Wisconsin in real estate. He's the person who negotiated most of the major Wisconsin DNR acquisitions in recent decades, including large forest legacy easements using the Land and Water Conservation Fund and stewardship funding. Hopefully we'll have some discussion about those funds today. And even though he's retired, not to sit idly by now in his retirement, he hasn't bought a rocking chair yet, I don't think.
Nope.
Dick's now serving as citizen lobby advocate for the Land and Water Conservation Fund. I understand he's been to Washington recently, so I'm serious about this this lobbying thing, and we need him for that. And then Gary Sirfuss, CPA from Winter, Wisconsin. He's a longtime career in forestry and tax accounting. Gary's been an active consulting forester and an accountant specializing in forestry tax issues. If you have any questions about that, he's the man to see. And then Matt Dahlman, Director of Conservation for the Northern Wisconsin area for the Nature Conservancy. And give him a little plug, pat on the back here too. Recent recipient of the 2014 Conservationist of the Year Award. Gathering Waters Alliance for Land Trusts awarded that, and that's quite a feather. So congratulations. And then I mentioned Joe. He's going to be representing basically forest landowners and their perspective today. So, Joe, maybe you want to first say a few things about what inspired you to do this. And
I mentioned Bob earlier, and I'm glad Bob's here today because it'd be pretty hard to say these things if he wasn't here. Back in the late 90s, mid-90s, maybe even started before that, Bob and I were... Well, I mean, how many conversations do we have about the possibility of a forestry co-op? You know, I mean, this went on for years and years and years. And we finally started putting something together with a steering committee, and that's when June first got on board. And Bob kept telling me, you got to be there. We got to do this thing. Well, I didn't know at the time that Bob was going to leave me do it. But anyway, our friendship survived all that. And we've been around for a while, but the important thing here is that we've got a stable organization. We've accomplished some wonderful things. I'm going to pass a couple things around that just to show the wide variety of our accomplishments. One end land conservation in a very small area only, and another one about the local lumber use bill. So I mean, we've got a very, very proud history, and it's really important that this organization stay alive. But as Rod mentioned, we're having some real issues connecting with the heirs of our original members, and that's where we need help. We need help from guys like you, Paul. We need help from foresters and even procurement guys that are interacting with landowners, because it's really important to keep an organization like this alive to keep accomplishing good things, but that's kind of the roadblock we're up against. We're losing members almost at an alarming rate the last couple of years to death, to old age and death, and it's really kind of, sometimes it gets pretty hard on me because some of these people are the ones that, you know, are original members that we served, and now they're no longer here. So just recently, Al Hogenmiller, who was one of our board members for a number of years, passed away. So, I mean, it's been kind of a tough time. I don't want to go any farther without recognizing at least I know of at least two people here that have donated conservation easements on their properties, and everybody owes you guys a great debt of gratitude for that. And I'm talking about June, when was your easement completed? 2000 and what?
06, I believe.
06, and Lee, yours in 2010. So, I don't know if there's anybody else here that's, we've got a lot of other members that have donated conservation easements, and we're really proud of that, and we're really proud of them. So I think it's really important to recognize that and show our appreciation continuously. The last thing I want to talk about before we get started with the panel is I've got an abundance of publications here. And you guys, anybody can take as many as you want. I mean, they're here to share with landowners. I've got a wonderful relationship with the state and private forestry folks in St. Paul. And if there's anything that any of you foresters see that you need more of, let me know, and I'll have them sent to you. So there's a lot of good publications, a lot of good educational stuff, so help yourselves. Help yourselves and share them with other people that can benefit from them. So with all that said, I think we'll introduce John and let him get started.
Before we do that, did you want to say anything about these maps and what inspired you to...
That's a good point, Rod. Back in... this fragmentation issue, surfaced really heavily over a decade ago. So about 12 years ago, I did some research, and I got these maps from the Department of Rural Sociology at the University of Wisconsin. And this shows the housing density in Wisconsin in 1940. So we can look up here and we can see a lot of green, a lot of black. It shows you the housing units. Okay, we can hand those around. And then by 1970, the landscape started to change. It started to change significantly, okay? By the year 2000, a good part of the state didn't look anything like it did in 1940. It's starting to change drastically. And then the projection for 2030 was even more drastic. So,
do you have this on your webpage?
I think if we don't have them on our Partners in Forestry webpage, I think I can find them because I think I still have them on PowerPoint. And I obtained these from a researcher with the University of Wisconsin Department of Rural Sociology back in the early 2000s. And I'll never forget the quote that he had with them where he said, "The growth of housing in northern Wisconsin is undeniable to the point where that has made very serious interference with traditional uses." So, and these maps demonstrate that. So these are nothing new. I've used these back in 2008, I gave a talk to the Kretz Forest Field Day. I used them then. I had a smaller version of the same thing in front of the Natural Resource Board when we talked about expanding the boundary for the Northern Highlands State Forest. So it's just sort of thing that this conference is linked to, yet we've taken it a step farther because in the last number of years, we've seen such a resurgence in the forest products markets around here with record high wood values, record high stumpage values, and yet there's thousands of acres in this area in Vilas County and surrounding counties that have been taken out of forest production for second homes to support a market that's literally unsustainable because there's an overabundance of second homes on the market at way less than their replacement value. So it's kind of a revolving issue and something that it's maybe pretty timely to have a discussion about. So with that said, somebody's going to say, well, if I want to grow trees for a long time, how am I going to come out economically? And I think John can start talking about that.
Okay, thank you, Joe. I'm just pretty much going to mainly talk about principles, economic principles of forestry, and not really bore you with too many details and numbers. Generally, as forests can be a very good long-term investment for landowners, but you have to have a couple of things there to make the investment. Three things that really make those investments go is, one, you have to have your forest health. The trees really need to keep growing. Secondly, the tax rate cannot be too high. Taxes can wipe away your your return. So basically the forests need to be enrolled in MFL if you're gonna keep them for a long term and make them profitable. So MFL program is just crucial for forestry and keeping forestry a profitable venture in the North Woods. And then thirdly, obviously, is your starting costs. If you pay too much for the land or too much for getting your forest established, that's going to really drastically determine what your rate of return on your investment is going to be. So you have to keep your starting costs as low as possible. So those are the really three things that can impact, you know, how profitable forestry can be. In general, forestry rates of return vary between 3% and 15%. That's the general range. And
over what time period?
Over the course of a rotation or of your investment horizon.
Is that an annual return or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Annual return. Are you making a distinction between the land and the timber? So when you talk about rate of return, are you focusing?
Just timber.
Just timber.
I'm not talking about land appreciation at all. Yeah, good point. Yeah, land appreciation could be additive or it could be, you know, negative to that. So trees can actually grow in value in three different ways. One is just their physical growth. And in general, good healthy trees on average across a wide variety of cover types. If you look at the data for Wisconsin, grow about 3% per year. So if you start with a stand that has 10 cords in it, next year it'll be 3% more than that, 10.3. And then there's always a little bit of mortality associated. So the net growth on most forest stands in Wisconsin is 2% per year, and that can go on year after year after year after year after year, as long as you have a well-stocked stand. And that's average. Some stands can grow much faster than that, and some grow slower. We can get into specifics about which stands are quicker growing later. And then the second value enhancer is, and I think the people here that are loggers and procurement people sure know this, is that timber prices over the long term, they will fluctuate up and down, but over the long term, they exceed inflation rate. And in Wisconsin, that's been about 1% faster than inflation over the long term. So from just the forestry landowner perspective, it's a good hedge against inflation. And that's why these big TIMOs, these big funds, these banking corporations, that's why they own these big tracts of land, because it is a really good hedge against inflation rate. They're not stupid. They're coming into Wisconsin, they're coming in the other states, they're buying big tracts of property, and that's one of the main reasons why they're doing it. Then the third value driver in forests, and this is kind of closer to my heart, is this is how the forester is impacted to a large extent, is your increase in grade for your trees. So that as a tree grows, it grows through these thresholds of different types of products. And if you have a tree that grows into the saw log category, it's jumping and making tremendous jumps in value as it grows. And that portion can greatly exceed the increase in value that you can get with just through growth or price inflation. That can give you a rate of return 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. Now you have to have crop trees that can do that, so you have to pay attention to quality of individual trees. So there you're actually going out into the forest and paying attention to individual crop trees. And you need crop trees in your stand to take advantage of that third aspect of growing timber. But it can be a pretty good long-term investment, but you need to have healthy growing forests, a well-stocked forest, to start with. Otherwise, you're just not going to get your growth. And trees in general will grow at a pretty sustainable, steady rate. As long as their crowns are healthy, they'll put on quite a bit of growth. Even the bigger trees will keep putting on quite a bit of growth. But as soon as the crowns start to decline, whether it's a pine tree or a hardwood tree, and those crowns are starting to thin out or they're losing branches, that's when growth really starts to drop. And if it's an even age stand, that's when you really want to think about then regenerating that stand, because you're you're really losing your growth rate. The growth of an individual tree is based on the ratio between the crown to the stem. Obviously, the leaves produce the photosynthesis and the carbohydrates to produce wood. And so if you have a nice big crown on a tree, it's really got a lot of ability to put on wood. If your crowns are starting to thin out, and I see this in red pine plantations that have been managed too thickly or too densely, this stands might be relatively young, but they've got really small crowns and not a lot of branches, and they're not growing very quickly. So that those are really the kind of the principles that we look at, is to try to maintain, you know, fast, well, healthy trees, and pay a big attention to your grade increase. And that way you have to, as an owner of trees, pay attention to the trees that you think can make saw logs. And those are your trees that are going to be straighter, and they're going to be, you know, don't have a lot of knots, and they're going to have at least 16 feet of, or even 8 feet of saw log material on the butt end to make a saw log. And those are the trees that are going to really jump in value as they grow. And when we do thinnings, we're letting those trees grow and add value. And we're taking out trees that can't add value, whether they're diseased or whether they're crooked or whether they're real knotty. And so if you manage your forest right, you're leaving these faster growing trees that can really jump in value. And that's where you really get your higher rates of return in your forest. Whereas if you do the opposite and you high grade your stand, you've killed any chance of getting enhanced value in your stand. And not only that, but you've left your smaller stunted trees to grow, and they're not gonna grow very quickly because they have small crowns. So if you thin your forest right, you're really gonna enhance your value, you're gonna enhance your rate of return. If you do it wrong, then you've really pretty much taken away the ability of that forest to be an economic, economical investment over time for a very, very long time. In fact, if you do it wrong and you high grade a forest, you pretty much, that's the first step into taking it out of production, because that forest isn't going to have a rate of return. There are going to be other investment opportunities for that stand that are much, much higher than forestry. So high grading really is the first step in turning it into farming or subdivisions or some other land use. So,
hey John, do you find with high grading that the trees that are left, that the seed that they produce genetically are inferior as well, or is it just the tree itself that's inferior? So would it take, you know, just one generation to work itself out, or will it take multiple generations to work itself out?
That there hasn't been a lot of research done on the comparing the genetics of, you know, the trees that might be left versus the overstory trees that were taken. My guess is there might be somewhat of a genetic change there, but what you have, you know, if you do have a high-graded stand, the best thing to go in is do a complete clear cut and just let the stumps, the sprouts come in and have new regeneration and start from scratch. That way you're developing trees with better crown architectures again, whereas if you leave suppressed trees or trees that are even broken, they're not going to respond to that release. Suppressed trees, in my experience, never respond to release. They will remain suppressed trees even after release, and they will grow in diameter, but they'll put on very little height growth. So that's one thing that you want to get rid of, your suppressed trees and some of your thinnings, because they're not going to respond well.
John, how does that fit with the constraints of MFL? Your MFL contract, MFL land, the constraints that you have to manage within, and you mentioned, you know, starting a hardwood stand over would be not something within the MFL program. Would that be, could you comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, if I don't think an MFL stand would get high graded to the point where you would make a good, your best decision afterwards would be to start it over. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that would never happen with MFL land. But I'm talking more specifically for non-MFL land where I've seen this happen. Mm-hmm. I would think hopefully that would never happen with MFL, you know. And I haven't seen it happen with MFL properties.
It'd be the first entry. Sometimes you see the first entry to MFL of degraded stands. You know, the first entry, the first time they're entering it before, you know, it's been looked at by a certified plan writer or something.
Yeah.
So you have some maple stands that have been high graded in the past. They're entered in an MFL, and then the question is, well, do you start thinning in a hardwood or you just start over?
My rule of thumb is 35 crop trees per acre. And the reason why you do that is because if I'm using a 15-year cutting cycle, then I'm, if it's 35 crop trees per acre, I've got enough trees there for six or seven cutting cycles. And if I'm cutting five or six good crop trees per acre, you know, per cutting cycle, I think that that's hopefully enough to have a good economic rate of return on that stand. And also, that's enough quality and value to offer to the logger for that particular harvest. Because you can't just mark a stand and offer no value in any one particular harvest. You need to always have some trees of value there that are going to be cut. The rule of thumb I've always used was the 35 rule. Whereas if you have 35 or more, then you go ahead and you try to release those trees and make that your future overstory. Whereas if you don't have that, and there's stands that don't have 35, there's stands that don't have 15 or 20 crop trees per acre, then I would get aggressive in regenerating it. And wouldn't necessarily clear cut it, but you could do bigger gaps or maybe shelter wood it or some other treatment. That's from an economic standpoint.
John, on suppressed trees, I agree that most suppressed trees aren't going to develop, but a few do, like hemlock, a couple of those can respond to release over the long term.
Yeah, there are trees out there that are what I call them ecological trees, and hemlock and cedar are the two that you keep them in the stand for, not for economic reasons, because they really don't have a lot of value right now. And Wisconsin is fortunate that our trees, almost all of our species, have economic value, and there's just a handful that don't. Or have very little, and cedar and hemlock are two of those. But and they would probably, if we could regenerate them and develop better markets. One thing about forestry markets is you have to have enough to create the market. Once there's too little of something, the market disappears, like elm, right? There's still a little bit of elm trickling out through the market, but there's not enough to create the market, because the people who use the product need a supply, and they need to know that supply can come. So your furniture manufacturers or flooring people or cabinet people, they have to have a certain amount. But you can't kill the market with too much of it at one time either, like the egg producers do. You know, you look at the prices. My uncle's been an egg producer in Wisconsin for a long time, so I watch the egg market a lot. And whatever happens to egg prices, as soon as they go up, they kill their own market because they overproduce, and down it comes again. So there's a sweet spot in forestry with regard to production. You know, you have to have enough for that market to create the market and keep a supply coming through it. But you can also, you know, like any other ag commodity, you know, you can also, you know, kill the market. So it's important to have that sustainable flow of timber in those species, because the buyers at the other end need to know that.
John, and yeah. Conversation is great, but maybe you know, before we get too much into all of the details of forest management with John, I have a kind of a dumb question from my novice perspective. If in Wisconsin it's said that, what, over 60% of the forest land in Wisconsin is privately owned.
Correct.
And from our experience with Partners in Forestry, we know that there's an awful lot of parcels up here owned by absentee people, and a lot of them are just hunting land. I don't think they do anything with the woods other than hunt on it, and it's an quote-unquote investment for them. How do we get this, you know, your introduction about your 3 points, so basic, and yet how many people out there have no clue as, you know,
well,
how to manage forest land, or what's good
with,
for it?
That's why MFL is so crucial. MFL is that institutional bridge to people that can, because most landowners only own their land right now in Wisconsin for a very short horizon. It's 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years. These forests grow a lot longer than that. Even on a 50-year aspen rotation, you're probably going to see a couple owners out there. You have to have that institutional bridge that's going to maintain that stand and growing. So that's why, I mean, MFL is just critical to the... the forestry in the state, and the consulting foresters are out there talking to people, and I think PIF has always been beneficial from my point of view in that you don't need to be an expert to make better decisions on your forestry land. What you need is you need a network of people to talk to and get some answers, but you don't have to be an expert to make a better decision on how you manage your land. So I've always, I thought, seen the real value in PIF being, you know, just that network ability to talk to landowners, and if they have questions, they can, you know, maybe, you know, find out an answer. But I've seen, you know, personal experience with people that I know, some private people do a great job managing their timber, and others are crisis driven. So their woods looks great until there's a family crisis, and then it gets butchered. You know, I can, you know, I've seen that happen. And it would, whether it's a divorce or anything else like that that happens in a family, or a bankruptcy, the timber is the first thing that gets sacrificed sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that part of the return on the investment for managing forests is being able to cut what one grows within forestry practices. The MFL, not the MFL specifically, but DNR's Northern Hardwood Management Guide for Hardwoods, in certain areas of the state, is preventing landowners from harvesting what they're growing. Where I work, Shawano, particularly Shawano County, Wapaka, the net annual growth in well-structured hardwood stands down there is around 250 to 300 board feet per acre. In a cutting cycle of 10 to 12 years, they are only permitting right now, using that guideline, harvesting about 1,000 to 1,500 board feet per acre. That's a big problem.
Well, a lot of your growth isn't board feet. Still a lot of your growth in that. That's 250 board feet, but that's averaged over all the products.
No, I'm talking about saw timber.
But still, you're not growing 250 board feet of saw timber.
Yes, you are.
On average, on a good stand, you might, but yes, on average, you're not.
I'm talking about a well-structured stand.
Shawano County's got that potential.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what you do.
And that's very important. That's important for the landowner, it's important for the water, and it's important for forest industry.
Well, what you see sometimes managing forests is that a lot of your crop trees might have the speed similar age. So you have a lot of your value if your fast-growing trees are in your 12, 13, 14, 15, 16-inch trees. And they may not be economically mature yet, but that's where a lot of your growth is coming. So when you're managing your forest, you're still releasing those trees, and you're taking out some of the crooked trees, you're taking out some of those other trees. So you're gonna look at that stand and you're gonna say, boy, I didn't come close to cutting my growth. And that's, and we're seeing a lot of that right now in Wisconsin. I know the industry, the sawmill industry, is really upset at the fact that if you look at the FIA data for Wisconsin, especially with sugar maple saw logs, we're only cutting a small fraction of the growth. Unfortunately, a lot of that growth is on 13, 14, and 15-inch trees right now. And are you going to go in and cut a tree before it's economically mature? See, that's because a lot of these stands, they're not all aged. And so you, as a forester, you go into that stand and you're taking out trees that you think are defective, or they're not going to grow as quickly, or they're not going to grow in value as quickly. And you can go, you can take two or three entries into a stand before you get a lot of those trees out of there. And that's what we're seeing a lot in Wisconsin right now, where a lot of our best growing saw log value trees are still, they're not economically mature.
That's just one facet, economically mature trees. There's more involved. There are some cases using arborgast or some other system like that where you will take out some trees that are not economically mature. Not everyone. My biggest problem, though, with that is they are forcing landowners to a certain degree down there to hold trees well beyond 24 inches, particularly red oak. I've seen this. I don't think this is true statewide. God help us if it is. But down there, that's a problem. And, of course, the industry and others have been trying to address this, and I don't really know how much success we're having.
Yeah, you can have down there, you might not be able to regenerate that stand. So if you cut it, you're gonna lose that resource.
You're talking about red oak?
Yeah.
That's all the more reason not to carry them to that size. You've got to do something besides select the harvest cut to regenerate oak. You have to get into some sort of shelter with that.
I don't even know if that's working there.
Well, they don't try it.
You know?
I just wanted to bring out that point. Forest landowners need to be aware that if they're managing hardwoods under the MFL, make sure you are able to cut what you grow. And if you don't feel you are, raise a stink about it.
You know, Rich, I had an experience almost very recently, too, and it's almost a little, maybe 50 miles southeast of or southwest of Opaca, in a different county, obviously, but it's actually quite contrary to what you're saying, because we had a red oak stand there, and the management plan showed us scheduled for two more thinnings. And it was time to look at one of those thinnings, and we asked the DNR forester to come in and approve that thinning, and he wouldn't approve the thinning. He said, I want you to do a shelter wood cut. So, and this was a stand that I had thought would go for another two thinnings before it was shelter wood cut. So this what you're talking about, and I believe you, and I think Shawano and Wapaka counties probably have some of the best hardwood potential in the state, I guess. But it can't be statewide, that attitude is what
I suspect it is not. I don't know. I doubt that very much. But there are certain areas where this is a problem. The fundamental principle is forest landowners should be able to cut what they're growing out there.
You eventually will, you know. But the question is, when do you do it?
Any other questions on that?
Just the many, forest land owners are entered into MFL for various reasons, and it looks like about 50% of them is wildlife habitat as one of the reasons they enter into the managed forest law. Of course, producing timber is very, very important too, but wildlife habitat. And I know many landowners who, as far as the red oak resource is concerned, want to maintain that, on their land for the wildlife benefits. And so, I'm not every landowner, but many do. And
true.
I know sawlog operators, people who operate mills for sawlogs don't like that idea because they want the oak timber. And yet the MFL landowners, at least many of them, want to hold on to that because
I think with red oak, there's been widespread failures with red oak shelter woods, and not just in Shawano County.
Well, Shawano's here.
But even other counties, there have been widespread failures in red oak management to the point where I think there's places where you don't even know if you're going to be successful if you try to regenerate that stand. I can show you places up north where they've done two cut shelter woods in oak, and it's turned into red maple stand. And that, generally that would work, but the deer came and ate all the stump sprouts, and the red maple grew right past them. And so that's a situation there where, you might be better off holding that tree. At least you're growing some red oak. And you have you still have some options. If you pull the trigger on that stand, then you might be left with red maple.
But there are successes with red oak regeneration down there, too. I've seen them.
Oh, there absolutely is.
Yeah, there's some good
jokes.
My experience, and I think it hits on what you're talking about, I'm one of these guys that anytime I see land sold by me, I go and introduce myself to the owner, and I try and encourage the MFL. And what I found is there's so many people buy land that's either in MFL or they get into it simply for the tax break, and they don't pay attention to what they're getting into. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where organizations like this come in real handy. You got to know what it is ahead of time. Do the walkthrough, understand the plan, spend mm-hmm. some time talking to them, and understand why you're going to be doing a cut that you may not want to go do 10 years from now, rather than wait 9 years and then just start bitching like hell because you got to cut these trees you don't want to cut. You should have known that going in. And I really see just a lack of understanding between property owners
that don't do their hands-on trees.
You know, we look at rates of return also at some of the stands that we manage, and a lot of those stands vary from $20, and I'm talking dollars per acre now, $20 to $50 per acre annually as far as the rate of return. You know, some of the good hardwood stands can hit $50 per acre per year. If you're starting to pay property taxes that are $20, $25 per acre per year, I mean, you're just wiping out your rate of return there. So you almost, as a forestry landowner, unless you've got a great veneer stand, you know, you almost have to be an MFL or some kind of a tax situation. Otherwise, you're doing is paying property taxes.
Matt, you had something to chime in about an MFL.
Yeah, I was gonna mention that I'm. excuse me, I'm a member of the Governor's Council on Forestry, and for the last year or so, actually it's been probably longer, about 2 years, we've been talking about revisions to MFL. It's ever since the Tigerton Lumber Company did the leasing, and it ticked everybody off. The DNR came in and said, no, you can't lease anymore, and that was a blanket statement across all of the MFL entries. And by the way, there's about 3.6 million acres of private lands in MFL. Well, anyway, ever since then, there's been a lot of grumblings about the program, even more so than what was in the past. So the council formed a team of people, internal and external people, and they came up with about 20 different suggestions and changes to the MFL law. And it would be restoring the right to lease, things that would allow, like if you had 10 acres and the minimum is 10, but your kids want to develop a house on an acre, you could withdraw that acre without pulling the whole property out and still allow the rest of the 9 acres to stay for the duration of your contract. So there are some things that, from a conservation standpoint, I didn't really agree with, but for the palatability of the program, it seemed to make sense, and to save the program, it seemed to make sense. Anyway, that legislation was introduced last fall, actually last spring, I think it was, and it never passed. It got beat up, never went anywhere, and in our last council meeting, which was in early November, there's been discussions about bringing that up in this next session, this winter, this spring. Representative Mursaw is on there and Senator Tiffany is on there. Mursaw is really the one that introduced the legislation last time and is wanting to write this legislation and bring it forward. Senator Tiffany, though, on the other hand, feels that because of a lot of the complaining that's going on with MFL enrollees, he thinks the program's essentially lived its course, it's obsolete, and that we should build a better mousetrap. And that mousetrap might mean doing away with the whole program and going to some use value assessment like it is for agriculture. And it sounds like a really good deal for us timber owners to have a use value assessment that would be something less than the ad valorem tax. But the reality is then what is the incentive for the timber products to come off? What's the incentive to do a practice that's guided by good sound forestry? So pay attention to that as that comes through the next probably January and February, there will be some legislation introduced, and there could be legislation introduced to essentially do away with the whole program. And I think, as you heard from John, that's a huge concern as we look at the ability to maintain, for private landowners to maintain timberlands as timberlands. That's a program that doesn't fit everybody, but for a lot of entries and 3.6 million acres of private lands, it's a good tool, and we need to keep that strong. So anyway.
Agreed. Good. Thank you, Matt. And is any other specific questions to what John was talking about or what Matt just interjected before we move on?
You mentioned veneer. And I know when I first came up here on our property in the lower end of it, we had huge birch, I mean, like this, and healthy. Are they coming back at all, or is that, they're dead?
Huh? You talk about white birch?
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of a fire-driven species, so they're only coming back in small pockets for the most part, not these large 40, 50, 100-acre stands we used to have. Yeah. So there's a lot less now than there used to be.
What killed them?
It's just age.
Mostly age.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing about a white birch is when they start to decline, they don't hang on and they die pretty quickly. Whereas some species like oaks, maybe white pine, even sugar maple in some cases, they may have some crown defects or some crown damage, and they can live in that kind of stunted condition for a long, long time. Whereas once the white birch starts to go, they go.
And those trees started with the big cut in the fires.
Yeah.
So the landscape's aging. Yeah. It's just a natural process. It's a pioneer tree. It doesn't live long. Yeah. And so unless we have widespread fires or whatever, you're not going to see white birch to where it was.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take...
John, you had said before that to keep forestry profitable, that obviously tax rates need to be reduced to like through the MFL program, but that's tax rates even in the MFL program have really gone up. How high do you think they can get before it really forces it, or before it makes landowners without really high value stands not profitable?
So just a comment on that, there's three things that were from the council that were kind of punted to the legislature, and that was MFL rates, because the close rate right now is 1068, and then the open rate I think is $2 or less than $2. There was supposed to be a recommendation on annual harvest returns for large landowners, and then the ability to close as many acres as you want as long as you're willing to pay the higher close rate. Obviously the Wisconsin Woodland Owners Association would like to see tax rates on forest land close to what we see with agricultural land, a couple bucks an acre. But the reality is, you know, if we shift that burden off of timberlands, where does it come from? So then our house, recreational or residential lands go up. So that's a tough one, and I don't know that we're gonna get any change in that rate. Local units of government have gotten that portion of that rate at 1068. I don't think they really wanna see that go down. So, but it's something, talk to your legislators and talk to them about.
But how high do you think it can go before an average stand is unprofitable to manage for forestry?
That depends on your starting costs. You know, if you pay very little for the land or you inherit it or something, then maybe you can pay $10 an acre for taxes and still be profitable. But if you have investment costs or other fixed costs, you know, then that's going to really eat into your investment or your rate of return. Yeah, that's a good question. I really don't have a specific answer to that, but that, you know, most stands, like I come back to, they're growing $20 to $50 per acre per year in wood value. That's what you see in Wisconsin. You know, they're really good pine and hardwood stands can hit that $50. And then, you know, maybe some of your slower growing stands or some of the stands that another thing I didn't mention before is profitability is also tends to be enhanced and you have a good variety of forest products coming off of your property too, so that you know, you're not beholden to any one fluctuation in the market. So if you can grow pulp and bolts and logs, you know, you're generally going to be in the longer term profitable because you've got more markets and you're not beholden to one market.
Good. That's Gary.
Well, could I add something on taxes?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good time.
Yeah, it's kind of. I have a different way of looking at property taxes. Okay. If I'm going to take $100,000 and I'm going to invest that in stocks, I can invest that full $100,000 in stocks. I'm only taxed on the gain I have on that stock when I sell that stock. I do not have to pay an annual fee to the government based on the value of my holdings. If I take that same $100,000 and I invest it in timber, I now have the opportunity to pay an annual fee to the government every year based on the value, or if it's an MFL, some other formula in taxes. So, you know, so you think about this. When our property tax system was developed, land was a good way to determine wealth. I mean, it was a good measure, a good yardstick of wealth, because we were basically agrarian, agricultural, and the more land you had, the more wealth you likely had. You know, the situation has changed over the years. That's no longer the case, but yet we stubbornly stick to this model. And I guess the question I have is, you know, why we stubbornly stick to this model? Why we, you know, why we don't look at alternatives? Another thing I think of is if I invest in manufacturing in the state of Wisconsin, they're well on their way to their income from manufacturing not being taxed in the state of Wisconsin. If I invest in farming, we're well on the way to the income that I generate from my farming operation, not being taxed in the state of Wisconsin. But because I invest in forestry, I get taxed. The forestry investment is starting out at a disadvantage just because of our taxation system. And that's my comment.
Wonderful. I would agree with that. I've watched what's happened in the last 10 years with the use value with ag, and not as aware of the manufacturing side, but certainly what you said about investing in the stock market makes sense. And it seems like the clout of the forestry owner compared to the ag owner is changed. I see a change. And it seems like the ag guys are doing pretty well with our fellows in the legislature, and the forestry people are doing less well.
There is a new organization being formed in the state of Wisconsin called the Wisconsin Alliance of Forest Owners, and Richard Redipole, who's a longtime advocate with Wisconsin Woodland Owners Association, is behind that, and that's specifically what they're talking about. And in fact, they're just ready to unveil their new website now.